Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be meeting writer and journalist Owen Hathley to discuss his impressive new tome, Trans-Europe Express, Tours of a Lost Continent.
Then we'll be hearing from the artist Paloma Varga Weiss, whose delicate and eerie wood carvings grace the gallery space Sadie Cole's in her new exhibition Wild Bunch.
And we'll be hearing from folk legend Shirley Collins, a singer whose extraordinary career has been dedicated to the preservation of some of England's most valuable cultural heritage.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, of course, will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll bring you some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom, it's one of those weeks, ups and downs, a warm and beautiful week in London, right? But where else would we rather be at noon on a Sunday than here in the confines of Studio One? It sounds like we've got such a great show lined up. Why have us nattering on?
Should we get
Fernando straight out of the news wardrobe?
On with Fernando. Here he comes out of that wardrobe right now.
There was something.
Hello, guys.
I can hardly see you for all the dry ice that you've insisted on having as you're walking.
Exactly. It's a lovely Sunday, isn't it?
It's a very warm day. Exactly.
Lovely sky blue shorts as well.
Yep, Rob,
is it sky blue? I'm a bit...
I think they're sky blue, aren't they?
Okay.
They are the colours of Manchester City.
My first story is President Trump and Kim Jong-un from North Korea. And I think they might, even though they're meeting only for one day, there are reports that they might be meeting on a second day as well. And if everything goes well, apparently President Trump is thinking to invite Kim Jong-un to the US. I'm not sure if this is happening. And who knows, maybe this will be cancelled last minute. But yeah, it's one of the stories of the day. It's not the most important event of the week, but...
And this is worth bearing in mind, of course, it's been... on and then off and then on and then off. You know, the vagaries are such that there's so many other things that could yet happen. Let's not start arranging a second meeting before this first one's well taken care of.
Exactly. Let's relax. But guys, of course, next week is the World Cup. I mean, this is the moment where I wait. Even as a non-football fan, I do get so excited, you know, about the event.
I think you have the great fortune of being Brazilian.
Exactly.
When it comes to... Yeah, exactly. You know.
No, and honestly, I've been thinking about that. Brazil's going through such tough times. And when I say that I want Brazil to win, honestly... I think our country deserves that after such tough years, because it's been proven if we win the World Cup, our economy will pick up a little bit. And it's not me saying, it's the economists, everyone is saying, for the sake of our country, please, Brazil win.
Well, hang on a second, Fernando. What's Brazil? Four-time winners, is it?
Or five times.
Five-time winners? I mean, share the wealth a little bit, no?
No. There are new countries in the World Cup. I think Panama and Iceland are there for the first time. I think, you know, it would be nice. I hope they go, you know, through the final stages as well. There are countries, Nigeria, purely because of their kit, which is amazing.
That,
it is quite striking and very graphic. Who are you guys supporting? Of course, England as well.
But I don't know. Maybe my second team with Japan. Italy always is a team I love. They're out. I know, and it's kind of weird. Yeah. So I kind
of... It's not quite the same without them. It's like the Dutch. They're the sort of part of the staples for me of the World Cup. It seems lunatic not to have them in amongst it. But there you have it.
And another thing, you know, everybody's talking about Russia, about the hooligans there. People are worried, you know, about Putin. But the reality is, from what I found out from the last World Cups, including the one in Brazil, which I was there actually, and in 2010 in South Africa, you hear all those horrible stories. But during the event, it's very unlikely that something very bad will happen. I'm not saying that everything's amazing, you know, there's the terrible costs and problems in the host countries. But during the World Cup itself, it's very rare. I'm pretty sure the Russian police will be careful with that.
Yeah, the FSB have apparently essentially put under house arrest every potential hooligan or troublemaker.
Really? And then they'll send them off merrily to the European Championships.
As long as it's without.
Yeah, exactly.
Interestingly, you know, Russia are the lowest ranked team in the finals. That's never happened before. An interesting.
They might be out of the group stages, like one of the few countries, the host countries. I think South Africa did the same in 2010. It's a shame, really.
It's the opening game they're playing Saudi Arabia. They should be able to beat them, shouldn't they?
Yeah, you'd have thought so.
Not sure.
We shall see. All will be revealed.
Exactly.
Fernando, we'll spin you around again this time next week. Thank you very much for the news. Look ahead. European cities work rather well. A stroll, cycle or tram hop around locations such as Berlin, Madrid or Stockholm, if we're strictly following EU boundaries, is often an experience boosted by smart planning, wide relaxed boulevards and some beautiful architecture to boot.
That's not to say that a little chaos isn't fun as well. There are exceptions to every rule, but it's the European way of looking at cities that's the focus of writer Owen Hathley's latest book, Trans-Europe Express, Tours of a Lost Continent. And he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, and good to have you with us. Is this a story in a way of a continent that's sort of divided in fresh new ways that maybe became apparent as you were researching the book? Or is that slightly to misrepresent it?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I suppose there's a sort of conventional east-west divide that people make, which I think is increasingly in Europe sort of replaced of a north-south one, and that being considerably more important. And that sort of mapping onto politics to a large degree as well. But also there was the sense that sort of Britain, for some time, like long before Brexit, had been at the very least semi-detached.
I like the way straight away we're into a residential metaphor.
Yeah, very much semi-detached, with a privet hedge and a big front garden.
It is like that though, right? What are the tenets? What are the differences that you found between European, whether it's city planning or the accident of it, and certainly what seems to be the accident of British cities?
Well, I think if you look at cities in, say, the 1960s, the difference between Germany and Britain is quite minor, and probably city planning is a lot more interesting in Britain. There's certain periods where one sort of seems to be more interesting than the other, and for the last 30 years, I would say that Britain has become, even when trying to do a sort of European-style city, has been doing it very much on the cheap. And I think that largely one can sort of put that down to the absolute dominance of market principles at every possible level in British life. You know, the kind of 19th century European city is different because it sort of has pre-capitalist hangovers, and I suppose the current one is different because of the fact that you still have things like strong trade unions and strong planning, which in Britain are considered an obstacle rather than a thing that will actually make life better.
So you, straight away, there's a political difference and an economic difference. And you're referring 30 years ago, this was the early days, 79, of Thatcher, and then through the 80s, when, what, there was a tidal wave that kind of changed the way that things were built. And interesting, in your introduction, in fact, you talk about Southampton and the way that they face.
Yeah, just the idea that you wouldn't want to face the water is a thing that
I love this, by the way, this opening, the introduction where you talk about Southampton, where I feel that, are you from there or originally?
I am, for my sins.
And I think you believe that for your sins, because there is that weird thing of, what on earth would, this is a famous port city, why are all the new buildings facing the road?
Yeah, and why is the road so big, and why is there only lorries on it, and why can't you cross it, and why are there no cycle paths, and why is there no public transport? I mean, Southampton's a bit of an easy target in a way. I think a lot of port cities haven't been as bad as that. It's just that was particularly atrocious. As a lot of the southern cities have been, even places that should really know better, like Bristol, that should be able to compare themselves with Hamburg or Marseille, you know, are basically Reading with some Georgian buildings and some hippies in.
Put that on your poster.
The funny thing, actually, is that the difference in city planning, in, when it happens in the 80s, is across the board politically. That although I think the kind of ultimate culprit for lots of this is privatisation and the kind of things that aren't privatisation but are sort of based on its principles, like PFI and public-private partnerships and just general idea that the market knows best, even when it's not actually a market. But that in the 80s, your left-wing Labour councils also thought that anything other than a cul-de-sac was totalitarian and evil. This is, they call it fascist rather than Stalinist.
This is public building?
No, I mean residential building in this particular case. So if you look at the way that Liverpool replanned itself in the 80s, it's almost exactly the same as the new kind of executive housing estates that are being built in places like Essex. It's long looping cul-de-sacs with, you know, houses with lots of parking space that are very introverted and look in towards each other and in towards their parking spaces rather than that the rest of the city. Mm. And that was the sort of reaction to modernism here in the 1980s, whereas the reaction to modernism in Germany, let's say, was much more about, I suppose, sort of encouraging some sort of conviviality. You know, if you look at the IBA program in Berlin in the late 80s, that, you know, they had practically every interesting architect in the world, like working on building tenement blocks with cafes on the ground floor and semi-private courtyards around the back and quite nice streets, and it worked really well. And in the last kind of 15 years, I feel that Britain has sort of tried to emulate that in a way, but not done so particularly skillfully.
What can I ask about that? Because there's always this narrative about British cities trying to sort of Europeanise themselves, and we do it with social policy and trying to sort of free up people to drink socially on the street and this kind of thing, to sort of urban theories. Is it a mistake for Britain to try and emulate these European cities that we look upon with fondness or with like jealousy almost to a degree? Or do we need to be more sanguine about coming up with our own solutions?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, there are things that British cities actually do better than their European equivalents, one of which is multiculturalism. And there's a sense that public spaces do work in a different way, partly because the weather is so awful. I think most of the principles are fairly easily applicable. And there's a lot of talk about things being to do with like specific cultural sort of traits of like the Dutch. Oh, well, obviously the Dutch cycle, that's what the Dutch do. You know, obviously there's like lots of trust in Sweden because that's what the Swedish are like. And it's, you know, this is the cart before the horse. You know, the reason why there is that culture in the Netherlands is because of the fact that there was enormous activism about it in the 1960s. Before that, if you look at a picture of Rotterdam, it looks like Birmingham. You know, that similarly in Sweden, the reason why there's all this sort of trust and people could talk about sort of, you know, the relative social peace in those countries and so forth, that comes from the welfare state rather than the being reason for it. So I think there's a sense that not necessarily if you build it, they will come, but definitely if, you know, you give people decent public spaces, they will use them. And I think there's no reason why, you know, somewhere like Bristol, for instance, couldn't have the policy on things like cycling and public transport that, say, Rotterdam does. There's no logical reason for it. There's no reason in terms of the size or culture or a local opinion to stop it. So, yeah, I think it is a model that would work in many ways.
I mean, can I ask if there's anything... I was going to say, if there's anything positive. What could be some positive things to look forward to, given the UK's explicit statement of its separateness from Europe via Brexit? Obviously, this is still a complete dog's dinner, and that's unfolding over the next 2 to 3 years. But could there be an opportunity to do some really positive decision-making, to make some restatements, be they explicit or implicit, about what kind of cities we want to have, our, I don't know, policy on urbanism, on housing, on the way that we engage with one another going forward? Is there an opportunity here for something positive? Because it strikes me there's a lot of very noisy negatives rolling around. What would you say to that?
I think the thing with the European mainstream, and the European mainstream that I praise quite a lot in the book, is that it has stayed still. And it stayed still now since, you know, all of its ideas come from like about the mid-80s. And it stayed where it is. And it doesn't want to go any further. And if anything, it wants to kind of roll it back a bit and privatise some stuff and, you know, privatise SNCF and other incredibly stupid ideas. So on that level, I suppose what Britain could be able to do is sort of take it somewhere else, somewhere that hasn't been thought of, rather than, you know, a kind of a nice new riverside estate with some cafes. You know, actually it could do something else entirely.
I live in a span house, one of Eric Lyons' houses down in Blackheath, and I watched a fascinating documentary by Ian Nairn about these houses.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, and it's got Eric Lyons expounding on the sort of a sort of utopian light version of a vision of what he had for these houses and how you could sort of see what your neighbours were doing, but not in a kind of nosy way, but just enough, la la la, could kind of foster a sense of community spirit, etc. I love it. But then at the end of the documentary, he realised that he lives in sort of neo-Gothic. He was like, sod that. I'm going to live in a neo-Gothic sort of manor somewhere down a very sort of leafy lane. Is there a bit of the problem of that in whether we're European, American or Brits? There is a little bit of that. There is a bit of the patronage of people that might not be able to have the neo-Gothic castle.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, but, you know, there's always a Richard Rogers of his knock-through Georgian house. But
yeah,
for every one of those, you know, there's an Eve Brown who lives in a block of council, lived until he died a few months ago in the block of council flats he designed. It's more, in the same documentary, Nairn goes to a tower block built for Southampton City Council by Eric Lyons. And it's the only one out of all of these places he visits, because he visits these very kind of quite neat estates in Blackheath. And he goes up to the top of this one and it's like, looks out at the water, which you can do there, unlike in most of the rest of the city. If you're 10 stories up, you can see the sea. And he's like, oh, I could live here if it was in London.
Maybe there we have it. Owen Hatherley, thank you so much for coming in. The book is Trans-Europe Express, Tours of a Lost Continent. Congratulations on it, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Time for some music now. We'll be hearing from the folk legend Shirley Collins at the end of the show. Here she is with the Albion Band with Just As the Tide Was A-Flowing.
One morning in the night.
Shirley Collins there with the Albion Band, and Just As the Tide Was A-Flowing from 1971, and we'll be hearing from the singer later. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, as we'll discover in the next couple of interviews, European folk traditions are facing an uncertain future. Paloma Varga-Weiss is an artist who uses her profound connection to the Bavarian craft of wood carving, both to keep the trade alive and to communicate her idiosyncratic, funny and sometimes unsettling perspective on the world.
The daughter of an artist, Paloma's sculptural career really took off when she was turned away from art school. Instead of joining her contemporaries hard at work, staring into their navels in the studio, she went to Bavaria, where she learned how to carve wood, local craft with roots stretching back hundreds of years.
Paloma's latest exhibition, Wild Bunch, has now opened at Sadie Cole's gallery here in London. She spoke with Monocle's Augustin Macellari and began by telling him more about what to expect at the exhibition.
The centre is a life-size marionette that is called Man Hanging, and it's hanging from the ceiling on a rope. The limbs are really like in a huge marionette on these balls, flexible. It's surrounded by, I think, 10 or 11 small sculptures that are fixed on small plinth on the wall. They are unique, standing for themselves on different topics, from animals to hybrid figures to women and standing deers. So it's a huge range of creatures, and the show is called Wild Bunch.
This wild bunch of beasts and of course, the mannequin, they're all rendered in wood, that's right.
That's right. Some are painted and burned.
And this is because, or in part, informed by your background, which is in wood carving.
That's true. I trained as a professional wood carver before I studied art. And yeah, I lived for 3 years in the south of Germany, in Bavaria, in a little town called Garmisch-Partenkirchen that has a tiny school for wood carving. And yeah, we were there, 5 students.
Does that tradition of craft really endure in that part of Germany? That tradition, is it still very much alive?
It's not. It's dying, actually, as the profession itself is needed anymore. So there is not a big interest anymore on having a Jesus or a Maria in your living room. So all these people don't have a work to do. And a lot of people who do this wood carving school end up going to an art school afterwards.
When you made the decision to pursue art rather than to become a craftsperson, did you see this experience which you had as opportunity? Or does it sometimes kind of represent a bit of a hindrance? Does it restrict the forms of your ideas? Or is it, in fact, like the perfect vessel for them to be carried out with?
I was refused from the academy. And because of that, I was joining this wood carving school by accident because I didn't get an entrance to the art academy. And so I learned this technique, and I didn't really know what to do out of it. I learned it, but then I went to the academy and I had really several long years with a lot of different things to do, from clubbing to whatever, doing videos, this and that, until I really end up being depressed and not knowing what to do. And then I restarted taking all my chisels and had a little stick and created a small creature. And this was like suddenly, yeah, the birth of this language started, that I could stand with all this inner growing, taking this chisel as a pen. Like, I know what to write then. I know how to write, I know writing, but what to write was then born.
And what was the reaction when you started making work in this way at art school like? Because my experience of it was very much that they wanted to move people away from painting and from drawing as much as possible.
When I started there and I told my teachers that I'm trained as a professional woodcarver, they said, forget it, you know, get this shit out of your head and just go on the river, find things, etc. So they really gave me a hard time. But at the end, after, and this is 8 years, you know, I was really a long student. Yeah, I found out that I'm happy that now I can say something with this technique I learned. And suddenly I did a standing deer. And this actually is a figure that is also at Sadie Cole's show now. That was like my last work I did at Academy. And it ended up being very successful and was an entrance to the gallery and art world.
These works that you've kind of presented now, I've seen some of them and they're beautifully rendered, but they're also very loaded with, I suppose, a kind of narrative suggestion. The way they're arranged around this figure, they have a presence. And I suppose I wanted to ask you a bit about the symbolism of them. So I wonder how you like your audience to kind of read these works or engage with them and what to take away from this kind of suggestion of narrative.
I think for me, the best way is to reach a point where it's just at the edge, but it doesn't really tell the whole story. You have the feeling like it could be this or that, and it has a reminiscence to this kind of works and that kind of history, and you feel it, but you don't really have it so present so that it still has its place to grow itself. So this is my wish, that the works have this place, you know.
I've read that you're inspired by paintings from the 15th and 16th century, which is kind of uncommon in the contemporary art field. And I suppose I wanted to ask a bit about your reflections on what it is that separates art now and that kind of academy, or rather institution style departure from tradition, from the past and from the canon of art history.
Mm-hmm. When I saw all these things that touched me, I needed to be in this emotional situation by myself to get a link to these paintings that you are talking about, like from Cranach to Holbein or Rembrandt and Dürer. I need a direct line from this work to my feelings to get something out of it. And it's very personal and it has this package. Otherwise, it would become superficial. It's the opposite of a Jeff Koons, who's, by the way, also using the same traditional copies of Greek figures or, yeah, a lot of contemporary artists are working with this language from historical works.
They're just not necessarily being very explicit about it.
Yeah.
I read that you had an interest in Louise Bourgeois and that you met her at one of her salons.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could just tell us about what happened there.
It was a special day. I mean, I had this appointment, I don't know, 2 o'clock Sunday coffee meeting. And the only thing you should bring with was some sweets from the place where you come from. So this was like the entrance. So when I approached to her house, I was a little bit early. And in the window, I could see a woman sitting behind these shelters. And it was like being in a Hitchcock movie, because she was sitting there in this rocket chair, sleeping, but looked like a mummy. Yeah, really scary. Then I ring the door and then an Indian woman opened, and super tough. She was her assistant, super tough organization. I got a paper to sign that I'm not allowed to, because they filmed this whole thing and you're having no rights afterwards to say something against this. So I entered, a lot of people came there, all bring their sugars, candies, sweets in the middle of the table, a huge bottle of champagne. And then Louise Bourgeois came out and she was so focused on this chocolate. And I heard that she had kind of illness where she was not allowed to eat so much sugar, but this meetings was the only time when she wasn't allowed. And all the time when she saw a work and she was not interested in, either she fell asleep or she was eating the chocolate and tried to open these packages. So it's a small detail, but it was so present and so rude in a way.
Yeah.
And so I had a little sculpture, somehow the same size as you see in the show, in a kitchen row towel. I came to her and I put it out and she loved it. And I told her, this was right at the beginning of my career and galleries came by, wanted to work with me, blah, blah. It was like a lot of pressure on me. And then she was very positive and she said, like, don't worry, just go ahead. It'll be fine. I can see it, you know. So I felt really lucky that she gave me positive and didn't fall asleep. And then the whole round was finished and she looked at me again and asked me, did I saw your work? And this was like telling me that she's already like not aware what she's doing. Like she couldn't recognize me like after 2 hours that I already showed her my work. So at the end, it was very disappointing.
Still, you got the green light, even if only briefly. Yeah.
She was a tough lady.
Yeah. That's such a blessing in many ways, it seems like, to start at the beginning to have that, you know.
And the house, it looks like an installation itself from her. Go in the basement to the toilet and it looked really like an old style toilet from, yeah, could be an installation of her.
And was it full of spiders? I read that It made sense to me when I read that you had this encounter, but also this kind of feeling for Louise Bourgeois' work. The other artist that I was put in mind of was Paul Arago, whose paintings I find kind of similarly loaded, I suppose. And I mean, I know that Paul Arago kind of fairly explicitly draws from folklore, but I'm also wary of talking too much about that with you, because I also read that you don't like your work being described as derivative from fairy tales.
Yeah, no, I hate it.
Unsurprisingly.
But I hate the word mystic and fairy tales and like a church language, whatever, because it doesn't come from there. It comes from completely a different angle. It comes from life, from things I see now, newspapers, images, hardcore sex, porno, whatever, websites. So this is where it comes from. It doesn't come from like I'm in a bubble of fairy tales and pray in the corner, you know?
Yeah, it's a red herring.
No.
I got distracted when you said it comes from a bubble of hardcore pornography.
I can show you later.
All right, I have to clear my schedule.
No, maybe there's a work that's called Glory Hall.
Yeah.
You know, if you have seen that, it's a huge hut. I did the show 2 years ago in Salzburg. I was invited from the Kunstverein. Yeah, we found a huge wooden hut where the Kunstverein was a pretty ugly building. And so I was thinking I need a stage, like a different platform for my work. So I developed this idea that the works are in this hut. So, and then the title came up, Glory Hall, because I realized that I thought that this Salzburg is a strange place itself. It's packed with so many different stories from Mozart over this Festspiele opera thing. And then anyway, so a lot of things were in my mind. So, and then this title came, of course, from this sex side where you only see through nut holes, or you fuck through nut holes, not nut holes, holes, but having this only a certain perspective where you can see through. And so I divided this hut into two sections, and one was for women and one was for the men. And the women was also marionette life size with a motor, and she was supposed to spread her legs, as the man had a huge penis size nose, and his head was going up and down like he's fucking himself. And the man was surrounded by trophies of animals like a deer, a bear, dogs, strange wise, and a lot of other trophies that supposed to be hunted by the Austrian hunters in this mountain area. And the woman was surrounded by two monkeys. They watched her spreading her legs. So it has a really uncanny, strange feeling, so that you could only see these two protagonists through this glory hole.
And casting the audience in this kind of voyeuristic role as well.
Yeah.
When it comes to your day-to-day process working in the studio, obviously the labour involved in carving these mannequins must be very substantial. To what extent is their outcome process driven? How intuitively do you work with the wood, and how fixed is your idea of what you want to end up with as you're going into making them?
It's a huge journey, and actually at the beginning it's not at all clear how it ends up. As for example this marionette, I had a vague idea, Bach idea, how it should hang, but we were trying a lot of different positions, how it ended up now that the face
is kind of pelvis up,
yeah,
isn't it?
Feeling. And by accident, my assistant told me a story about a mountaineer who died in the Swiss Alps in the 30s. His name is Tony Kurtz. And I checked his story. And suddenly I saw the image how his body was photographed. The death of this group of alpinists was a huge thing for the press because there wasn't that much press following mountaineers. And so this image became an icon, how he was hanging in his robe thing. So, and this then suddenly came up while I was working on this figure and gave me another input how, yeah, I could put more into this figure. And I think this is an important part of my work, that it's never clear at the beginning how it ends up.
You also have some drawings in this exhibition which are from a lot earlier in your career.
Yes.
I'm interested in how willing you are to look back and bring either techniques or imagery or anything like this from the past into the future, but in a way that doesn't seem nostalgic.
Funny that you're asking me this, because when I looked into my, I say, storage of drawings, what I could select for the show, I was so thrilled by seeing these old drawings again after years. And I speak about like more than 10 years. I haven't seen them. And suddenly, like after I did the work, suddenly I saw I made a drawing that exactly has this figure already done, and I never saw it. And even these limbs are exactly how I produced it without remembering it, that I already had this little sketch. But it was never, it wasn't a sketch, it was an idea. And so it's a circle that now comes back, you know. And I found this is a bit scary, that you see suddenly it's about life, that life is in circles, and you could see it in this experience I just had for myself.
That was Paloma Varga-Weiss in conversation with Monocle's Augustin Macellari, and Wild Bunch is on now at Sadie Cole's here in London.
Singer Shirley Collins' influence can be seen not only across the British folk scene, within which her work as a performer, interpreter and collector of traditional songs has been defining it since the 1950s onwards, but she's also responsible for helping preserve some of the US's oldest musical traditions too.
As a field recorder, she travelled across the United States, along with archivist Alan Lomax, in 1959, recording rural voices from singers whose lives stretch back to the 19th century. Following an extended break from performing, she's now back on stage. She'll be at Birmingham's Supersonic Festival later this month.
But she's always returned back to her roots in Sussex to find inspiration. And her recent book, All in the Downs, referring to the hills that run through the area, collects some of them. Monocle's Tom Hall recently met Shirley in the town of Lewes and began by talking about what the English folk identity means and where Sussex sits within it.
It's a really difficult word, isn't it, these days, Englishness? But for me, Sussex is Englishness. It's the countryside, it's the culture, it's that memory of all this really great culture, a love of the countryside with the people who worked it, even though, you know, their lives were very hard. And I just grew up with a family that loved England and loved Sussex. And yet, I've always been aware that England is not the green and pleasant land it's supposed to be, and yet I wouldn't want to be anywhere else or be from anywhere else.
Come in, come in, you old true love, and chat for a while with me.
I'm glad that you said that Englishness is a difficult word, because it is. And, you know, we're living through a very strange moment as well in, well, Britishness, which we should make clear is not the same as Englishness. But the UK, obviously, with things like Brexit and stuff, we're having this complete crisis of what this place is. What do you think embodies Englishness at the moment?
That is such a difficult question. I mean, I want to remain in Europe. I'm a European. My order of belonging is Sussex first, England next. Great Britain I don't have that same sort of feeling for. But what, just at the moment, I just find it so difficult to reconcile being English with the English. You know, there's so much antagonism towards so much at the moment. And I mean, I think in a way we're almost in despair because, you know, we've got such a dreadful government, we're facing leaving Europe. I don't feel awfully hopeful. And yet, you know, at the same time, I just think things will work out. Whether they will or not, I don't know. But it's still important to me. I mean, England is home. And I think that's true of everybody, you know, wherever they are, if they're out of their own country and living somewhere else, their own country is still what they think of as home. And home is Sussex.
Let's talk about Sussex. I'm from here and I've been reading your book and it's been really nice because I think sometimes familiarity or over-familiarity sort of breeds a bit of dismissiveness. How do you keep looking at the place you grew up, Sussex, in fresh ways, and how does it keep sort of renewing itself for you?
Well, I think it's partly the seasons help renew it. Every few months, the whole thing changes. I mean, just bowling along the lanes at the moment with the trees, the May in full bloom, the scent of the grass coming through, and the sight of the hill, you know, the downs, it just replenishes itself all the time. I gaze on it and I love it and I just don't ever get tired of it. I don't know. Does that make me sound like a bit of a twerp? I don't know. It's just that I love it and I can't help it. And I like loving it as well. You know, I'm quite proud to be from Sussex.
Early in your career, you came to London, you got involved with the folk scene there. Tell me, what kind of performers were you seeing at that time when you first moved there? And a lot of them are sort of incredibly well known today, but, you know, a lot of them would have just been your friends on stage. What kind of people are we talking about?
I mean, people were turning up from all over the place. There was people coming down from Northumberland, Louis Killen, who was one of the fine singers. I mean, there were people like, you know, Paul Simon turned up. One of the concerts I did when I was quite young, really, was at the De La Warr Pavilion in Bexhill in Sussex. And I've got the poster from that that says, the Waterson Quartet just back from their nationwide tour, but we think they'd just come down from Hull. And it was Shirley Collins, Britain's versatile young instrumentalist, which I wasn't. I could hardly play my five-string banjo. And then the bottom of the bill was Paul Simon. It was the first anybody had ever heard of him. And of course, you know, Bob Dylan turned up at the Troubadour Folk Club in the coffee bar in Earl's Court. And nobody reckoned him much at the time because it was the first time he'd sung. And he sang the two songs he was allowed to sing and then just dived off to the loos and smoked dope for the rest of the evening. So, you know, we didn't reckon him very much.
Well, the preacher was a yelling and selling his hope. The price was too high, so I said no. And the swan on the river was laughing by. The swan on the river went gliding.
But a lot of people, well, certain people afterwards said, you know, years later, oh, I recognise his genius straight away. But I don't think they did. Because it wasn't very apparent then.
I'm curious, has your view of him changed over the years now, or do you still not think very much of Bob Dylan?
No, I mean, I like him. I like him well enough, you know. I mean, I don't like the Christmas Carol album, the recent thing. But, you know, he used a lot of good English traditional tunes and set. I mean, he's a good poet, you know. I don't actually listen to him by choice. He's not my top favourite, but you can't dismiss him, can you?
It's true.
And I don't like it when the singer's ego comes through, which, you know, a lot of the singers do if they're professional singers. You know, it's sort of them first and then the song second. And I think it always should be the song first.
You travelled around the southern US with Alan Lomax. Tell me a little bit about that trip, because that really fascinates me, because a lot of those singers, I imagine that was a time when you were sort of catching a lot of them before they passed away. And they were from a very bygone era, you know, very racially segregated. I guess some of them maybe stretched back to the 19th century. Would that be correct?
Some of them stretch back longer than that. But in the mountains of the Appalachians, I mean, those settlers had sort of been there for 300 or 400 years, not moving on, and nobody encroaching on their patch, you know. And so the music that they had brought with them from the British Isles was still really being sung, but, you know, just slightly altered, name places altered, names altered, and tunes, they just become Appalachian tunes. It's interesting how that happens.
She rolled, just came to the town, and there she put up beside of the crown. The first one she met with was English Lord. The next one was Captain Pretty Polly's True Love. What news from your country? What news do I hear?
But the other segregation, I mean, yes, it was dreadful. To our shame, but you had to do it because there was no other way to do anything at the time. Just, you know, we swam in segregated pools and in our spare time and ate in segregated restaurants where we went after we'd recorded in the Mississippi State Penitentiary, the dreaded Parchman Farm. We moved up into the hills of northern Mississippi where there was an entire black community, and a lot of their songs were pre-Civil War songs, and a lot of the stuff had a really African feel to it, but they had survived, you know, so wonderfully in that area. And it was there, of course, that we met, I mean, my favourite blues man of all times was Mississippi Fred McDowell, and it was the first time he'd been heard really outside that community. So that was, you know, just the most wonderful thing. It gives me goosebumps to today when I remember how Fred was going to come after work. He was picking cotton throughout the day, and in the evening there was this rather slight figure in dungarees carrying a guitar, just walked into the clearing where all the shacks were, just still in his work dungarees, you know, and then he sat down and played his first blues, which I think was 61 Highway, and it was the most marvellous sound, that the shimmering metallic sound of his guitar, his slide guitar, and Alan just wrote one word in his notebook, and that word was perfect.
Lord, there's 61 Highway, it's a long road I know. Lord, there's 61 Highway, it's a long road I know.
And so it was, and, you know, he had such a big repertoire as well, and he was just the loveliest. I mean, they all were there, they were just so welcoming and so friendly, and they just loved their music, and they also loved the fact that Alan loved their music, you know, which he did. You know, people like to be appreciated like that.
Are you sort of interested in just taking away all of the fancy airs and graces and just hearing the plainest song possible, or are you sort of happy for people to theatre it up a bit?
I just like the distinctiveness of what people from a certain region sing. And I mean, youngsters, you know, a lot of them want to sort of jazz up the stuff or, you know, make it lively and throw themselves around the stage while doing it. I just don't see it like that. I just think the songs are the important thing.
We live in an increasingly multicultural society, and I just wonder whether a lot of these kind of old folk styles of singing, they're incredibly sort of naturally tied, I guess, to the old England, like a sort of white England, but we live in a much more colourful, multicultural society than that today. Do you think that these kinds of songs are capable of reflecting that kind of multiculturalism? Because I think that's maybe why people start to disconnect from folk music, because it is of its time. You know, a lot of it is very historic and talking about ploughing in fields and stuff, which people don't do anymore generally. So, I mean, do you understand why people might disconnect from it a little bit?
Yes, but no. I mean, you might say the same about Shakespeare. You might say the same about Saxon churches. You might say the same about the landscape. You know, let's concrete it over because we need more houses. No, let's protect it. What's valuable?
There's a really great quote in your book, which isn't necessarily linked to that, but I think you'll have to correct me. I think you said that maybe your uncle or your dad or a relative said it. You said that cynics take comical things seriously and serious things comically. Explain that.
Oh, that's my uncle Fred. He's a writer. He wrote biography of Robert Tressel, the ragged trouser philanthropist author. That's set in Hastings. No, that's just his view of life. He was quite cynical, but not about things that he loved. I mean, like literature, he wasn't cynical about that. When he grew up in Hastings, which is a Tory town, you know, forever, I mean, he was striving to be a writer, but having to earn his living emptying gas meters during the day. Yeah, I mean, so you have to be a bit cynical, don't you? You can't sort of be living with rose-coloured spectacles all the time. And I think it's a sort of good, honest way to be.
Do you think that cynicism lifts as you get older? I find it does, because I used to be very cynical and hard-nosed when I was young. And now I think I'm much more patient with things.
Yeah, I don't think I'm cynical either. Why would you want to be? It's sort of, it's a bit deadening, isn't it? It just sort of flattens things. But even so, one likes an occasional cynical rejoinder.
And I also just wanted to talk about just a few of the little anecdotes in the book. One of the things which, when I read it, it sort of comes out of nowhere, but you were talking about you and your sister Dolly in Hastings, and just out of nowhere, you're strafed by a German fighter plane, i.e. shot with machine guns from a plane as you're walking up the street. Talk me through what went on there and, you know, how that affected you going through life at that young age.
Well, I mean, Hastings was sort of front line for bombers who were going to London, and they were strafing a lot on the coast, and some bombers, if they didn't reach London, you know, they'd turn back and they'd just sort of let the bombs drop over the coast. And there were what was called hit-and-run raids, where the planes just came in up from the channel and just did what damage they could. And yes, Dolly and I were walking down Harold Road pushing our cousin in her pram. But Mum had told us that if we saw a plane we didn't recognise, to just, you know, get under a hedge or out of sight if we could. Because we knew what planes were, which planes were English, because we knew the Spitfires. We always used to wave at them, because the planes flew fairly low as well in those days, you know. So we waved and cheered at the Spitfires when they went over. And then we saw this grey, dark grey plane coming up, and it just didn't look right. We threw the pram in the hedge, and us two as well. And as we just lay there, the bullets just, you know, hit the road, right up the road in front of us, spraying up. And we could see the cross on the underside of the wings. The thing was, you recovered from it because you were young and you didn't expect it to happen again. I mean, in some ways the war was okay. I mean, we were bombed out. We had to go and live with an aunt because our house was hit by an incendiary bomb. But, I mean, you could do things like collect shrapnel, you know, from the bombs and swap it with other kids, you know, and you could collect jam jars and take them and get a halfpenny each. There were the things you had to do during the war to sort of make money, and you were required to do it in a way, you know, to just recycle everything. It was the start of recycling, I think.
Everyone is always going to think that their own era growing up was unique, but to grow up in the confines of an actual ongoing world war, you know, it doesn't happen to everyone. How do you think that maybe affected your generation, I guess? Why did you find yourself sort of turning to things like folk music and stuff to sort of express yourself? Was it to do with the time, or was it just to do with your personality?
It was to do, I mean, partly due to the war, because my sister Dolly and I slept in an air raid shelter during the raids, and Granny and Grandad would sing to us. And some of the songs that Grandad in particular sang were folk songs, although I didn't know that's what they were at the time. So it was the war, in a way, that, you know, introduced us and just kept us feeling safe. And I just loved the tunes and I loved the words, even as a young kid, you know, just fascinated by it. And I think I must have just acquired so much knowledge from them and so much, you know, the sound of what they were singing. And it was a comfort and it was a pleasure as well. So the war was sort of responsible for that, because otherwise they wouldn't have sung to us night after night. And I was just so grateful, you know, later on in life that I was able to work with my sister Dolly and to work with Davy Graham and David Munro and just get, you know, wonderful accompaniments to the songs.
As close as before, and what
what was it which sort of pushed you to take that break in your career, if you can explain that? It must have been a difficult time. I understood that you had problems with your voice, is that correct?
Yes, I mean, it was all down to bloody heartbreak, really. My husband just left and didn't even say goodbye to the kids. It was like sort of overnight, and it was the day after a wedding anniversary. And I was at the National Theatre trying to sing, and just, you know, in the Albion Band, and I just couldn't get notes out some nights, and I would croak. And it just got humiliating, and I kept trying to sing, and it just got more and more humiliating. I've got two kids to bring up. I had to stop and take proper jobs, you know, other jobs. But the thing was, I didn't stop learning songs or listening to songs all those times. You know, I just kept them going in my head, never thinking I would be brave enough really to try to sing again. But after lots of persuading by David Tibbett especially, you know, who was a great supporter, I just found that I wanted to do it again.
You returned to making albums in the last few years. You released Lodestar, which was really well received. Are you looking to make more fresh albums now, or is that something that was more like a sort of a conclusion to a period in your life, or is that a new beginning?
It's a new beginning. In fact, we're already starting to work on the second album from Domino, but this time I'm going to record it not in my front room here, but in the proper studio, rehearse everything well, and then go into a studio and do it. I've sort of got the bit between my teeth again. And I just love the music so much, I really want to sing it, you know. And there's so many songs that people aren't singing, you know, they want to write their own and call it folk song, and it's not. You can't write a folk song. It's got to have undergone that, you know, process sometimes through centuries to reach the point where it is a folk song.
Is that really true, that you can't write a folk song?
Of course it's true.
Can I just ask, who wrote the first iteration then? Does it have to go through the generations?
It has to. I mean, if you're going to say, yeah, well, you know, like Louis Armstrong did, all music is folk music. I ain't never heard a horse sing, you know. It's a glib thing to say. And what that does is it dishonours the people it came from. You see, I'm just so keen on this working class music because that's what it is. And yeah, modern working class music is totally different. But there's no reason why we have to lose this as well. Just let it be folk music. Let it be traditional music. And it was Alan's point that the best thing you can do for a community that's being disregarded and treated so badly is to record their music and, you know, their art and let people see what their culture is, you know, give that to the world, and that reaches far more many people that way.
Now Polly is married, she lives at her ease. She goes out when she's ready, returns when she please. She left her old parents to weep and to mourn.
Shirley Collins there, talking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And Shirley's most recent album, Lodestar, is out now, along with her book, All in the Downs. Listeners here in the UK can catch her show at the Supersonic Festival in Birmingham, which takes place between the 22nd and 24th of June. This is the Monocle Weekly.
Well, that was a very merry show, Tom.
Incredible.
I very much enjoyed that. Nice to have... You don't hear enough of Lewis.
I know.
Weirdness of Lewis.
You were punching the air with all that Sussex chat that's been going on.
It's been good stuff, hasn't it? Today's show was produced by Augustin Macellari and Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and Sarah Myers. The Monocle Weekly will be back again, same time, same place, next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.